The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. A lot to talk about in our environmental section, which is the second part of our program, the latest on the very rapid melting of Greenland's glaciers. Remember, for the last 10 years, I've been telling you that it's all happening faster than any mathematical model, hence we're in chaos theory. Well, today, on the science website dealing specifically with glaciers, they have some photographs that are startling, and I'll give you the latest on that and what that means for all of us. Our issues today will deal with a commentary from Op-Ed News from Sherwood Ross on a slavery system. You heard me right, a slavery system that's causing some riots in occupied states, and why this should be concerning everyone in the media. And it's not. Not a word about it. You hear about it first here today. From What Can We Do to Make It a Better World segment, how about 10 Reasons to Buy Organic from Ronnie Cummins? The latest on health and healing, and my guest today in the third part of our program is a return of Dr. Nasir Ghami. He is a professor of psychiatry. He specializes in depression-related disorders. He's a Tufts University medical professor and Harvard Medical School professor. Last week we began, but I felt that there was a lot more I wanted to ask. For example, how is it that Adolf Hitler was so charismatic, and yet what was his mental state? And how about some of the others, Gandhi? What do they all share in common? We're going to get to this whole idea of our leaders having mental conditions. Let's get into the topic. Always we start with health and healing because it's something we can do daily right now without anyone else to make ourselves live a longer and happier and healthier life. Science Daily, reporting on the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. It's very easy, very simple. Quote, a lifetime of physical activity yields measurable benefits as we age. Now, we all know that the benefits of physical activity, any kind of real physical activity, accumulate across a lifetime. So think of all the people who were really athletic when they were young, in their teens and 20s, and then stopping athletic. They're still ahead of the game versus people who've never been athletic. But what if you continue to be athletic your whole life, or what if you start in the second part of your life? It's all to the good. Trouble is that we are spending too much of our leisure time physical activity in front of computers and not moving. This is the latest study, and this is based upon research of anyone born after 1946. Quote, maintaining physical performance, that means exercise, and muscle strength with age is important given that lower levels in older populations are associated with an increased risk of all health problems, loss of independence, and shorter survival times. And unquote. And that's from Dr. Ralph Cooper, Medical Research Council. So what's this mean for you and I? It just means this. 6 days a week, go out there and bike, but resistant bike. No light gears, only the most difficult gear. Power walk, very important to do that as well. Jogging, excellent for you. Jumping rope for 5 minutes, phenomenal for you. Speed, agility, and breathing, aerobics, flexibility. Jumping rope is phenomenal. Swimming, especially if you're overweight or have any pressure in your joints, then run from one end of a pool to another. That allows resistance, the water, and against your body, but it also is an easy way to do it because there's no trauma to the tissues. So we can do this, but we have to do it every day. And if you do this every day, you build up a lifetime of physical fitness, and that's very important. Let's say that you're traveling. I'm traveling right now. In fact, I'm living out of a bag every day, because sometimes by the time I finish my film shoots, pre-interviews, get into a car, drive to the next location, get out, set up my camera, do more pre-interviews, get everyone seated, do the filming, get what I need, thank them, get on to the next location. Well, try finding a place out in Oklahoma to eat a healthy meal. You can eat standard American meal. You can get plenty of Jell-O and steak and mashed potatoes and french fries and all kinds of junk foods. But the kind of food I eat, organic, a lot of it raw, no, it's not going to happen. So I take my own foods with me. I take powders with me, and they just do fine. But I also take things in case I should in any way come in contact with parasites, viruses, bacteria. I take about 15 different items. And I've shared those with you, how to create your own natural medicine kit. It doesn't take much, a little tiny bag, and you're good to go. I'm adding something new to it, and I want to share this with you as well, because anytime anything new that's been substantiated in good science, we should add it. This is from the Journal of Medical Microbiology, a major peer-reviewed journal. Now, what's one of the worst bugs you can get out there? Well, E. coli. Also add in Salmonella. And add in Bacillus cereus. And even the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, or MERS. All of those strains can put you in a hospital. Many can kill you, especially the MRSA. And what do we do about it? Well, historically, you get sick, you go to a hospital, and then you hope that they have an antibiotic to help you. Here's something that can prevent that and help you if you get infected. Coriander oil. Yes, the same coriander that's used in Indian cooking, almost never in American cooking. It also gives the rice that very unique aromatic flavor. Coriander oil has now been shown to have a very broad-based killing action against toxic, harmful bacteria. And it can help with foodborne illnesses. It can even treat antibiotic-resistant infections. So this is good. This was done at the University of Beira in Portugal, and they put 12 of the most deadly bacteria into petri dishes, exposed them to a solution containing 1.6% coriander oil or less, and it killed all of them. Well, how about that? Now, in Mediterranean cuisine, coriander is used for its aromatic qualities. But the oil, which is different, is one of the 20 most used essential oils in the world, but is never used in America. It's produced from the coriander plant, and it has a lot of health benefits. Just as a herb, it can relieve pain, it can ease menstrual cramps, it can help stop convulsions, it can cure nausea, it can aid digestion better than ginger, and it can treat fungal infections, from vaginal fungal to toe and fungal infections. So any of us who've used this in helping people that we're counseling know that if a person has candida or topical infections, and a lot of people come back from camps in the summertime where they picked up fungal infections. It's called beaver fever. You get in the water of the lake, which is great, and you forget that, well, the beavers and the deer and everything else is defecated in the lake, and unfortunately those just don't dissolve and go away and disappear. They float in suspended water molecules indefinitely, weeks, months. And you jump in, you're having a lot of fun, you swing out on the inner tube, splash, do your cannonballs, all good. But then you're gulping it away, and you get home, and You realize, I just don't feel right. I don't know what it is. Doctor checks, you're okay. Well, you could have that beaver fever. Campers frequently come to a spring, and it's flowing over rocks, and someone says, but any water, like a waterfall that flows over rocks, kills the bacteria and parasites. Therefore, it's safe to drink. No, it doesn't. That's just one of those urban myths. For those of you who are scouts, and I was a scout, clear up to life scout, and a scout master for 10 years, we know that having survived in the woods, which one of the things we have to do to become a life scout, you have to go in the woods for 10 days, they weigh you before you go in, then you have to survive, not just survive, without losing weight, which means you have to eat, but you have to build a lodge, you have to build an oven, you have to do all these different things to show you can survive. And then they come in afterwards and they take a look at what you've done, and if you've done it right, then you can get tapped into what's called Order of the Arrow, which is one of the most unique survival groups, and that was always the highest honor where I grew up in scouting. And I remember when I went in to the woods, first thing is you build an up above ground structure. You get into a tree, you haul up everything. And mind you, oh, did I forget to tell you, they give you no tools. You're not allowed to have any tools. All you're allowed to have is one pocket knife. So you have to create your own fires. You have to do everything with just this little pocket knife. So you have to create a structure that you can habitate in. Why? Because you're out in the woods. There's copperheads are going to be drawn to your heat and can bite you, and rattlesnakes, water moccasins. There's all kinds of critters, including bobcats and mountain lions and bears. And so you have to be up. And then you have to, in the daytime, or down. In any case, the very first night, I didn't have a chance to build anything up, so I found a cave. I'm thinking, this is good, so I created a barrier. And I got the thorniest bushes I could find. They were about 5 feet deep and about 6 feet high. Literally covered almost the whole front of this cave. So I made myself a fire about 2 feet inside the cave and just leaned against the wall. And I had a whole bunch of berries and some roots, and I was cooking the roots and eating the berries. Everything's fine. And then about an hour later, I start hearing the noises. And I knew it was a bobcat. I'm looking to see if I could see the bobcat. And only about 10 minutes later, I realized the bobcat was in the cave with me, not on the outside. Well, at 16 years of age and being very strong and wiry, I think I must have set some kind of record for throwing aside this barricade, running down a hill and into the middle of the water where I figure it wouldn't get. So there I am in this freezing river right in the middle, and that's where I stood for most of the night. And next morning I got back up there, and sure enough, I had made my little place in the wrong environment. In any case, for those of you who enjoy being in the woods and nature, and I do, never drink water out of any stream, brook, because it's always going to be polluted. Always. That's how we get amoebic dysentery. But the tricky thing about amoebic dysentery, you might not know you have it for weeks or months. So that's why each day when you're out and you're going to camp, and I'm certainly a big believer in going to camp and enjoying nature, just realize even at the ocean you're going to get water in, and you won't find anything more toxic than our oceans. Just do this. Before you go into the water, just take 20 drops of wild oregano oil and about 15 charcoal capsules. Then when you are exposed to these, they're trapped and neutralized and taken out of the system. But then when you get out of the water, take it again. That just gives you a backup protection. And that's how I'm able to travel all over the world. And I mean, I travel places where I can't even get a camera person to go. It's not like one of these nature shows where they have a whole full team and armed guards that you don't see. They're off camera and they're fully protected, yet this guy makes it look like he's up against this cobra, up against this crocodile. Trust me, there's a whole army of people behind the scenes there making sure nothing adverse happens, and they sleep in trailers or they have these That's not how I do it. So add this, add coriander oil into your antibacterial essential survival kit. One more thing on lack of exercise. 79 million American adults have prediabetes. Another 25 to 30 million have diabetes. So we're up over 100 million, or one-third of the entire population, have diabetes. One of the principal ways we end up with prediabetes is we have elevated glucose because we are not exercising. Here's the latest from the Department of Nutrition and Exercise Physiology and Internal Medicine at a major university, and it says the following. Inactivity, which means lack of exercise, linked to risk factors for type 2 diabetes. So the more you exercise, the less likely you are to be pre-diabetic or diabetic. And finally, good news on vitamin C. It's been shown to help reduce oxidative stress in the brain, and that can protect from dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, all of which are from inflammatory agents in the brain that cause defects in the genes, the neurons, and cause adverse effects with your mitochondria, energy factories. Vitamin C can dissolve those toxic proteins in the brain. They can help prevent brain problems. That's all good news. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. We have an environmental section today, then we have our issue, then we have our guest, and then your calls. Let me start with our environmental issue. First up, new photographs just taken of a humongous glacier in northern Greenland have for the first time shocked the scientific community. In fact, one man was rendered, quote, speechless. In August of 2010, part of the Petermann Glacier, which is, give you an idea, it's about four times larger than Manhattan Island, it broke off. And that caused everyone to go, what, what? You know, that's an enormous amount of ice to break off. And that's how glaciers end up into the ocean, and that's how the oceans rise. A glacier is a body of ice that sits on a rock base and that's sitting at an angle, at a gravitational angle anywhere from 3 to 10% elevation, which means that it's melting, it goes towards the ocean, much like if you're on the side of a hill and there's lots of rocks and trees you can hold on. If there's not, if there's just mud, you're going to slide right in, down. That's a glacier with water underneath of it. Now, the hotter it gets, the more that water starts to pool at the bottom, and that acts like a skid. It is like a 1040. It's allowing it to slide into the ocean, and that's what creates more water in the ocean. Remember, ice in a glass doesn't create more liquid in the glass. An iceberg doesn't create, when it melts, any more water in the ocean. Glaciers do. And here's what researcher Alan Hubbard of the Center for Glaciology at a university in UK had to say, that, quote, this is really weird. Although I knew what to expect in terms of ice loss from satellite imagery, I was still completely overwhelmed. I was rendered speechless when I actually saw it. Now, that's bad. Why? Because it's abnormally warm, and while sea glaciers calve, that means break off, giant icebergs break off, that's a natural process. But the breaking off last year is bigger than anything ever in the last 150 years. And this region, which is northern Greenland, is experiencing temperatures which are abnormally warm. and they're seeing a whole new climate change in Iceland and Greenland and that Northern Arctic area. So what this means in lay language is this. The warmer the globe is becoming, the more you're going to see hurricanes, more of the torrential rain, colder climates because global warming creates more severe winters with more snow and hotter summers and drought. The oceans warm up, and as the ocean warms up, that creates a greater intensity of the hurricane, hence what might have been a tropical storm, tropical depression, or Category 1 can become a Category 2 or 3. All this is bad news. But it also means that what we thought would be no problem for the next 30 to 40 years if you live near the ocean, now he's saying the next 5 years. So we're going to be hitting some really bad situations in the very near term, and that's unfortunate. Now, this is our issue of the day. And this is one of those things that we don't hear about, and for very good reason. Because if people knew what I'm about to tell you, it would cause them to get upset, both Democrats and Republicans. And we don't want that. Because then if they have to be honest about anything, which they never are, they would have to face the fact that the unintended consequences of being in places we shouldn't be is that we're causing enormous amount of suffering. So I'm going to quote verbatim Sherwin Ross. It's a short piece, but boy, is it important. Many of the 70,000 third country nationals, what are called TCN, third country national service workers, employed by the United States government in Afghanistan and Iraq, quote, recount having been robbed of wages, injured without compensation, subjected to a sexual assaults, and held in conditions resembling indentured servitude by their subcontractor bosses, unquote. That's according to Sarah Stillman. And it's an article entitled The Invisible Army. And in fact, the arrangements, as reported, are virtually slavery. Interesting. How do you approach President Obama, who's fully aware of all this, and allow him to understand that he is sponsoring slavery? And there's no other way around this. Who has the courage to call him out on this? Well, no one, no Democrats or Republicans or their supporters, but maybe some independents and progressives could, if ever given the chance to get in the door. Quote, these workers, primarily from South Asia and Africa, often live in barbed wire compounds on U.S. bases. Now, I didn't say barbed wire around the bases. I'm saying inside of a base, they're held in barbed wire enclosures. They eat at meager food chow halls. Quote, a large number are employed by subcontractors who are financed by American taxpayers who operate outside the law. Unquote. Now, since the U.S. invasion, more than 2,000 separate contracting companies have hired 70,000 people, and there have been 51,000 injuries in these people. That's like 80% in Iraq and Afghanistan. Quote, these soaring casualty rates are now on par with those of U.S. troops in both war zones. Now, although President Obama said in 2009 he would make good on his campaign pledge to do better by these contractors, the number of these contractors brought into Afghanistan has increased by 50%, reaching 17,500 just in Afghanistan, with no apparent improvement in their lot. Indeed, the deplorable conditions on the bases, these are American military bases where contractors are employed, have triggered widespread rioting. For example, did you know, quote, previously unreported worker riots have erupted on U.S. bases over issues such as lack of food and unpaid wages. This is according to Stillman's report, based upon labor camps run by Prime Projects International on the largest military base in Baghdad. More than 1,000 subcontractors, meaning the actual workers, primarily Indians and people from Nepal, rampage using fists, stone, and wooden bats, and as one military policeman put it, anything they could find, unquote. quote, employees started to throw gravel at the managers. 4-foot pieces of plywood crashed through glass windows. Workers broke down the door to the food cellar and made off with as much as they could carry, unquote. And several weeks later, workers in a nearby camp run by subcontractor Golf Catering Company staged a copycat riot, quote, pelleting their bosses with stones and accusing the company of failing to pay them proper wages, unquote. A manager in another camp operated by KBR, remember them, the former Halliburton subsidiary, told Stillman about conditions that triggered one riot. One of the employees at one of these camps described how 1,000 Indian and Sri Lanka men under his supervision personally slept on crowded floors. No mattresses, no beds, where rats and flies attacked them. No communication. They had no television, no soap to wash or bathe, no visits from anyone from the company KBR. The workers had no choice except to go out and protest, unquote. Now, mind you, that's from a manager getting money from the Pentagon, all of which we, the public, pay, and all of which President Obama and his entire cabinet know about because these are all part of the morning briefings. Now, many of these 70,000 people are hired by private employment subcontractors who promise them high wages but only pay a fraction of what they're promised. They're also lied to even the basics, and they're told that they'll have wonderful sleeping quarters and great food, and all of which are lies. Stillman reports, quote, military privatization of jobs has produced convoluted change of foreign subcontractors often lead to cost overruns and fraud. The Commission on Wartime Contracting recently warned of the dangers associated with, quote, poorly conceived, poorly structured, poorly conducted, and poorly monitored subcontracting, unquote, particularly noting the military's, quote, heavy reliance on foreign subcontractors who may not be accountable to any American government authority. The racket begins when the Pentagon outsources prime logistics contracts worth $15 billion a year to Dyne Corporation and KBR. And these prime vendors take most of the money, and then they shop the bulk of their actual grunt work to hundreds of global subcontractors, many in the Middle East, almost all corrupt, and they engage in what the State Department has said is human trafficking, and then they're not non-compliant because they're in Iraq and they're in Afghanistan. Virtually anything they want to do with someone, they can do and have no recriminations. Stillman, who interviewed hundreds of these workers in the process of preparing her article, said a typical story was that of a 25-year-old Taco Bell employee on a major U.S. base in Iraq who paid a Nepal recruiter $4,000 to get a job in Iraq, where he was told he would make his investment back quickly. In May 2009, the man found himself housed in a shipping container behind the U.S. Embassy in the Green Zone, where he slept on a soiled floor with 25 other migrants. Quote, many learned that they were to earn as little as less than $3 a day. And they would cook and be servers for U.S. soldiers. And so none of this is actually sensationalized. This is just the other side of George Bush and Barack Obama's war. 70,000 people today held as virtual slaves are called third country nationals. Everyone in the armed forces knows about them. Everyone has kept this a secret. Shame on the New York Times and everyone else for refusing to report this. I don't shame Fox for anything because they're beyond shame, and O'Reilly and these other clowns are afraid ever to tell the truth about something. They'd rather just dismiss the fact that America is engaging in slavery and human trafficking. And yet all these people, because they're former suck-ups of Cheney and that motley crew, get away with it. Not a good story. Not the kind of thing we like to hear. And certainly not something that those people who pride themselves on their ultra-steroid nationalistic fervor, we are the best. Really? Then if you're the best, explain how President Obama can justify slavery. What would happen if Martin Luther King had gone over, seen the conditions? Imagine the conversation between King and Obama about, we both won Nobel Prizes for peace. I earn mine. How do you get yours when you're knowingly providing the foundational protection with no investigation of keeping 70,000 people in Iraq and Afghanistan doing grunt work for their armed forces under slave conditions? That's the issue. Hard-hitting? You bet. Needs to be talked about? Absolute. Going to be talked about anywhere? No. Why not? It's obvious, isn't it? Card-carrying Democrats, you know, the Obama Democrats, the Clinton Democrats, the ones who love to talk about, you know, all the good things. This is a part of the story that shows the rot underneath that dynamic. And, of course, Republicans have no shame, so I'm not even going to begin to give them the dignity of having any compassion for anything anyhow. Those are my thoughts. Yours up right now, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We're going to go to my guest in just about 60 seconds, but before we do, here's our special. Now, I haven't had this on special for over 2 years. Why? Because we've been actually out of this product for over 11 months. And the reason we were out of it was because I couldn't get all the ingredients. So the manufacturer called and said, well, we can do it with, you know, half the ingredients. I said, no. I said, just wait. We'll be out of it until you get everything. Well, we finally today actually got the product back in. And quite simply, it's one of the superstar products I've ever created. It is called Super Antioxidant. Vegan capsules, 90 vegan capsules. And this is a group of the superstar antioxidants. And what antioxidants do, look, in any research book, antioxidants protect the body from the destructive action of free radicals. And the right amount, the right combination, can help prevent a lot of free radical damage. And that means that you're doing an enormous amount of good, especially when you're doing something at a high potency and synergistic blend. So this is the superstar. What's in it? Well, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin B6, magnesium, zinc, selenium, copper, astaxanthin, quercetin, L-carnosine, lycopene, rosemary leaf powder, tocotrienols, raspberry leaf extract, citrus bioflavonoids, rutin, bilberry fruit extract, red wine concentrate, grape skin extract, Chinese green tea, reduced glutathione, L-cysteine, coenzyme Q10, N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid, yes, that same alpha-lipoic acid, superoxide dismutase, taurine, pycnogenol, licorice root, broccoli stem, lutein, cabbage leaf, carrot, milk thistle, and bromelain. No, there's no peer for this. This stands alone, in my opinion, is the single greatest antioxidant in the world. It's all the important antioxidants in the right combination, in my opinion, the best possible thing we can do to protect ourselves each day. I've been out of these myself for 11 months. I'm on the road, and I said, FedEx me this tomorrow, I'll tell you where I'm going to be because I can use these. Anything that's going to grab those free radicals and neutralize them, and each one does a different job. Put them all together and you have a super job. Super antioxidants. Buy one and get one free. However, I only have 400 bottles. That means I can only take 200 orders today. I'm sorry. I'll get some more in another couple weeks, but this is what they got us immediately. And this is vegan capsules. Buy one, get one free. Super antioxidants, a superstar, superstar. Everyone should be taking this every day. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go to our guest in a moment, but first let's go over and see if we have, I'm going to see if we can find some people. I'm going to ask my engineer to tell me on my headset because where I'm at, Mike, I don't have the computer access. And if you'd like to call in and talk about what I discussed, about what we're doing to use people. And mind you, here's how it works. Gigantic contracts are given to favored insider people inside the military-industrial complex. They get those gigantic contracts, frequently no-bid contracts, because of who they know and who's with them. They, in turn, keep most of that money for themselves, give out a little bit to someone else, but that doesn't trickle down to actually help the people. And at the bottom, they get scraps. And that's how it works. So if you'd like to call in, share your points of view, please do so. And we're going to go to my guests in just a second, but I'll wait a moment before we do that, just so you have a chance to call in and share your points of view. While you're calling in, let me just mention that we're adding something new to our September 21st event. This is a really phenomenal evening for social activism, education, meeting some of the finest activist minds in the world who are coming in. The people who run the Ethical Culture Center, very nice people. I've been there many times. They called yesterday and said they're willing to open up the doors early if we want to show Knocking on the Devil's Door. And that just kind of blew us away, because that kind of niceness you don't find very often. So I said, yes. So now, if you choose, if you want, it's your choice to watch the full director's cut of Knocking on the Devil's Door. We're going to show it at 5 p.m., 5 at night. It'll be over at 6:30. That gives us a half hour for people who are going to be coming in for the 7 o'clock press conference and discussions and meet the people from Japan and France and around the world, and Vandana Shiva and Greg Palace and Carl Grossman, all the others. And then that goes on for an hour and a half or so. Then we have another break. Then we show the full film, Death by Medicine. So it can be a whole long evening for some of you, or whatever part of that you want to come. It's only $25. You're getting over $110 of value for $25. You're going to walk away with two videos and a book, plus you could watch two different full-feature films. But we are closing out this whole process by Monday. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. I don't know if I have any calls or not right now. So let's go to my guest. Is my guest standing by? Let's say hello once again to my guest from last week. He is Dr. Nasir Ghamei, which is G-H-A-M-E-I. He is a professor of psychiatry specializing in depression-related disorders at Tufts University Medical School. He is director of the Mood Disorders Program at Tufts Boston Medical Center and also serves on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. He has authored over 100 scientific articles. He is also the author of A First-Rate Madness, Uncovering the Links Between Leadership and Mental Illness. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me back here.
I'm going to pick up where we left off. First, before you do anything, I'm going to ask you to give an overview of this whole idea of the inverse law of sanity, as you call it, where you've
right.
identified four mental illnesses which enhance leadership characteristics rather than impair them, and where you're going to give us an understanding of the main beneficial traits associated with people who are creative, empathetic, resilient, and realistic. And then manic leaders who can have some part of that, but not all of it. And then compare some people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King to people like, let's say, George Bush or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. And then we will pick it up from there for the second part of our interview, all right?
Okay. So do you want me to just review that briefly for the audience?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yes. So the basic idea I have in First Rate Madness is this inverse law of sanity, as you said, which means that oftentimes our best crisis leaders appear to have had mental illnesses, specifically mild to moderate depression and mania, and some of our worst crisis leaders were very mentally healthy, didn't have any of those symptoms, and were very average and normal. And I think this is because compared to normal people, research studies show that some conditions like manic depression can increase realism and empathy. Those are both shown in studies to be increased with depression, and creativity and resilience to traumatic events, both increased in manic individuals compared to normal subjects. This doesn't mean that normal mentally healthy people can't be good leaders, but it does mean that there's actually some advantage to those who have some mania and depression in their experience to possibly to be better crisis leaders because of these four traits which have been shown to be enhanced by these conditions in scientific studies. So basically I apply what we know from the scientific evidence in normal, in the general population to our historical leaders as well. There's no reason they should be exempt from those facts if indeed these studies are true.
Okay.
Do you want me to go on as you suggested about the examples or?
Yes, please give us examples.
Okay. So probably the most proven examples would be Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln, which I think there's enough agreement that the documentation is very good, that they each had very severe depression, even some suicidal periods in their lives. And Churchill also, and I tried to show, had some manic symptoms as part of his usual personality when he wasn't depressed. Other people who are, other leaders who are less well proven because the evidence is less definitive, but there is available documentation, I think, to make a reasonable case that there was depression in the experience of Mahatma Gandhi, for instance, and Dr. Martin Luther King, both of whom made suicide attempts in childhood and had periods in adulthood that meet current definitions of clinical depression. I also discuss John F. Kennedy and Franklin Roosevelt for this concept of hyperthymic personality, which means mild manic symptoms as part of one's temperament, one's personality. This is not a mental illness. I don't say it's a mental illness, but it is an extreme abnormality of personality traits, which is biologically and genetically related to bipolar disorder. And that mild manic personality made them more creative and more resilient, I think, than many others. Others that I mentioned are General William Sherman and Ted Turner. I don't just mention them. I study them in some detail to describe how they had manic episodes or manic symptoms and how that might have related to their creativity, Sherman for his total war concept and Ted Turner, of course, for his cable news concept, which was new at the time. And I study these people based on primary source documents, letters, primarily contemporary accounts. And in some cases, I did my own personal research, which was original research, especially with President Kennedy. I think I'm the first psychiatrist to go through all his medical records, and I document, in his case, in great detail, a lot of these symptoms as well as treatments that might have influenced the symptoms, such as the steroids he received. Those are the main people I cover. I don't cover everybody, but I didn't really choose those people. They chose me in the sense that I was looking for documentation, which really requires, I've concluded, about 50 years of time before we really have adequate historical documentation on medical and psychiatric facts. Right. So most of these figures are from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century.
I'd like to use just two examples for a moment and a little overview. When Bill Clinton was talking about how he supported a healthier, cleaner environment, instead of bringing in the one human being in America who did more to create the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, protect old forests from being destroyed, Al Gore, and the same Al Gore that we have today, and Bill Clinton brought in individuals from major industries that were speculators, meaning gas, oil, coal, and they literally ran the programs and then went through the process of taking these away, meaning our rights, and we ended up with a really major drop in the effectiveness of laws that would protect us when things got into the environment that were polluting. Separately, instead of engaging in stopping the Rwanda conflict, which over 90 days caused 800,000 people to lose their lives, the State Department was telling him, we have genocide. He chose not to become involved until after the fact. When it came to the war in Serbia and the bombings and came to other conflicts, it was always one-sided. Come to protecting American jobs, and he got reelected on no small measure by going to the unions and getting the unions to say, you know, this is our man, and then he enacted GATT and NAFTA, and the world trade organization, which has just virtually eviscerated the unions. And then when he came to protecting our economy, he got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. Now, those are just some of the issues. In Protect the Poor, he downsized the welfare rolls. And so, on the one hand, talking to people with great sincerity, I feel your pain. And on the other, doing just the opposite, it only creates that pain. And yet, never once turning around and saying, I'm telling you one thing, I'm doing another. And he, more than any other president in my lifetime, mastered the art of looking in the eye and telling you just the opposite of what he was about to do or would do, and was never really held accountable, even by his constituents. How do you deal with that when people are lied to, manipulated? They still like the person who did it because of how that person developed a bond with those people. Could you explain that?
Well, I would want to emphasize the point I made about needing 50 years to really know in a reasonably definitive way about a leader's medical and psychiatric reality. But that said, I think that with some of our recent leaders, I wrote more about George W. Bush and Tony Blair. Sometimes what we have are leaders who are trying very hard to seem average, to they emphasize being normal like the average American. And if that indeed is the case, and they are pretty much average Americans, mentally healthy, they don't have these severe manic depressive symptoms or extreme personalities, one of the problems that could happen is that when there's a time of crisis, they don't have enough realism, empathy, and creativity to meet the high demands of a period of crisis. And I think that's another issue to bring up. When is there a period of crisis and when not? I focused on the major crises that I think most people would agree in the last 100 years or so, going back from mid-19th century to the mid-20th, that is the Civil War, World War II, the Cold War, and the Civil Rights Movement. I did skip World War I, but that's mainly from space limitations. Those are the major crises. Of course, there are smaller ones. The question really is whether maybe we could ask whether President Clinton was tested in the years he was in office by major crises. And one way of thinking about it is that the Cold War had ended, the 9/11 crisis had not yet begun. And so in a way, he may have been functioning in an interregnum where things were, you know, not obviously completely peaceful, but relatively speaking, relative to other major periods of time, less full of military and economic crisis. And in that kind of period, you know, lots of people can function well without having a lot of these traits of crisis leadership. Maybe he was able to get away with more than he might have otherwise, but I'd say it's hard to say. I think at this point I would be reluctant to make many judgments, either politically or psychologically. Probably it will take more time for us to learn more about the facts of the matter in relation to President Clinton.
Okay. Now let's deal with this. There's good evidence to conclude that Hitler suffered from both mania and depression. At the same time, we have discovered that many of the Nazis tried at Nuremberg were in fact very mentally healthy. Then you have to say, well, if you're mentally healthy, how in the world could you possibly have participated on any level in the genocides? And many progressive thinkers have suggested the U.S. has descended into a kind of fascism. Sheldon Wolin, retired Princeton professor emeritus of political science and one of our nation's most insightful political historians, has convincingly shown the U.S. has entered a political state of what he calls inverted totalitarianism that can lead to the American population surrendering their individual freedoms in order to accept a fascist order to feel secure and protected. So I would like you, please, to answer your own question in light of what you have researched about the psychological underpinnings of Hitler's and the Nazis.
Right. Well, this is, I think, a good issue to discuss in some detail, and I thank you for bringing it up. What I found was that when you look at the Nuremberg Nazi leaders, the two dozen or so leaders who were tried there, which represented all the leaders except for Hitler and one or two others who had committed suicide. By and large, the vast majority of those leaders were carefully psychiatrically analyzed with interviews repeatedly and many psychological tests over a number of years, and were found to be basically mentally healthy, not extremely abnormal in any major way, not diagnosable with any serious mental illness. And that's really interesting, it seems to me, because a lot of people want to view the Nazi period as an aberration, as a period of insanity. And well, I think it's not scientifically defensible to say that in the sense of the majority of the Nazi leaders. Now, if we say that maybe Hitler himself was insane, that's another issue. And to some extent, my research, and I try to document this again as best I can based on the primary sources, including his medical records that have been evaluated by physicians in the past, interviews with his doctors and childhood acquaintances. He probably did have mania and depression, so he's diagnosable, I think, with bipolar disorder. But he also got intravenous amphetamine from 1937 onwards on a daily basis to try to treat his depression. And that treatment, of course, is very, very dangerous and harmful for people with bipolar disorder, causing them frequently to get psychotic and out of control. So it's very possible that he himself had, indeed, very extreme and harmful abnormal mental states. But nonetheless, I think the other Nazi leaders not having that kind of illness brings up the question of how he managed to convince them or how they managed to agree to go along with the Holocaust, with the genocide, and all the other activities that happened. And I think one of the conclusions that we need to at least consider is that for most people who are mentally healthy and normal, it is not unreasonable to think that under the right circumstances, they might follow a leader like that, or they might follow policies that are very extreme. And, you know, under normal conditions, we might consider totally evil. But under those conditions, a lot of normal people went along with it. And I think that raises the possibility, indeed, that it's not an aberration that happened one time in some kind of crazy way, but that it's something really that could happen anywhere with any country.
I would agree with that, but I wouldn't have to go clear back to World War II because many of the atrocities only came out at the end of the war, especially when the Russians, who were the first, and then the English and then the Americans liberated Auschwitz and some of the other concentration camps in eastern Poland and then in Germany. Only then was the full extent of that type of extermination present. But much earlier, there were many other instances. We have the Iraq War. Knowing full well there were no weapons of mass destruction, we did not stop our efforts, apologize to the world, and retreat. Instead, we doubled down, and we've been doubling down ever since with some terrible consequences, but as long as they're suffering. For example, last night, I took a break in my filming, and I watched a Glenn Greenwald documentary about Afghanistan. And there was a scene in this where there was a father with his children. This was the wintertime, and it was cold out. You could see snow and ice. And three of the children had no shoes, and they were standing in cold water. And the father said, "I had no food, I have no blankets, I have nothing. And I had a home, I had all kinds of foods that I grew, my family always was well fed, and now I'm trying to sell my daughter. I will sell my daughter for anything I can get from her." And here's this daughter, and he says, "Do I want to sell her?" "No, I don't want to sell her, but I have no choice. If I don't sell my daughter to someone, get some money, I won't have any food to save the other children." He said, "No father should ever be put in this position." And then it went on to show all these other people that we never hear about and how they're going through similar things. Then Greenwald showed that every one of the people in that shot died in the next 6 months. And now the lowest amount of death we know is about 300,000. The highest is 1.3 million. It's probably closer to a million dead civilians. And yet not a single discussion, article anywhere, as if we can go to war, we can bomb, we can do what we want to do, and there's no consequence. There's no moral consequence. There's no thinking about it. And the same thing was true in Vietnam until the end of the war when the pilots began. People think that the American public, got us out of Vietnam. They didn't. It was not the marches. I was a part of it. It wasn't the marches at Columbia University or Washington, D.C. Before that, it was the soldiers refusing to bomb. It was them throwing their medals in front of the White House. It was them protesting that shamed us. And then around that grew other movements. But we had to shame. We had to shame a country into recognizing what we had done at My Lai and every place else. 2.4 million dead in Vietnam. No one's apologized. A million dead in Iraq. No one's apologized. 900,000 homeless vets. No one apologizes. So I'm looking at this interconnected, and I'm saying, what have we missed? Now, here's my final question for you. You have an interest in spirituality as well as Sufism. Now, as a psychiatrist, do you find yourself questioning the mental capabilities and the sanity of leaders, particularly among Republicans like Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin and Rick Perry? And I'm not just isolating them. I could go across to many Democrats as well, who embrace religious beliefs that almost defy common sense reason in the 21st century. And I ask you this because I feel there's a certain religious belief that I would characterize as deranged worldviews. And we know the impact certain worldviews have on decision-making. So can we be certain that a person who embraces a deranged worldview is not also mentally unsound?
Well, certainly it can be that when one has mental illness and it's very severe, it can be harmful. And I'm focusing on mild to moderate symptoms that can be helpful. I can't really say about these leaders. You know, I don't have the documentation and the knowledge about that for these specific people. What I would say, though, is certainly there can be leaders who are unsound and harmful, as well as many who are sound and helpful, and unsound and helpful, I should say. One of the issues is really who the people follow, because the leaders are important, but so are the followers, the relationship to the leaders. And one of my concerns, as I try to describe in A First Rate Madness, is that mental health in the majority of the population often translates to conformism, what some psychiatrist researchers call homoquite, the term that I describe in the book. It's for the very average person in the 50th percentile of all the psychological traits and studies. That kind of person, when he's examined in detail, tends to be very conformist. And, you know, for instance, conforming to whatever the religion of his culture is and whatever the general attitudes of his culture is. And I'm more but very conformist rather than specific leaders who might be either mentally abnormal but courageous and realistic and creative, or maybe too abnormal and then harmful. But what really matters is how we can try to follow the leaders and get leaders who can head us in the right direction. And I think one of the problems here that comes up in this research is that the majority of the population tends to, because of its conformism, often go with leaders who are just following the old routine, not trying to fix these kinds of problems that you're raising. And I think that's a difficult question.
Okay, let me end just by a thought I have. And if it has any meaning, fine. If not, that's okay. I think your book is a wonderful read because it challenges our thoughts. And anyone who decides we better start thinking differently if we're to get a better outcome, you're clearly leading that direction right now. So A First-Rate Madness, in my opinion, should be read and then offered up to our own psyche for challenge. I would also argue that scientists, and I would include psychiatry, generally know very little about happiness and the different kinds of happiness, which I believe in some cases are abnormal. I can think of one immediate example. Oftentimes people who are narcissistically self-absorbed in themselves are those who most lack empathy for others and the ability to feel or relate to another person's suffering. Yet at the same time, as you have stated, we are biologically hardwired to be empathetic. And there's sufficient neuroscientific research based upon brain scans showing some people are more empathetic than others. And one impressive example that comes immediately to my mind would be the work of Dr. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. And his MRI research performed on Tibetan monks showed that when they were in a state of happiness, brain activity, including areas of pleasure, were 100 times more active than controls who simply conjured their normal states of joy. And that may not mean much until we realize that a fundamental practice throughout Tibetan meditation that is emphasized over and over again is consciously acknowledging the deep suffering of others, in fact, all of life, and then they're generating feelings of compassion and a desire to relieve others from suffering. So if this research is in any measure of true or artificial happiness, I would challenge that many of those who might consider happy, and I would include George Bush, are in fact abnormally happy. The image of Bush in a video making fun of a person on death row prior to execution is one example of a happy-go-lucky guy with almost an absurd streak of pleasure in possessing the final say of a staying execution or not. Final thoughts.
Right. I think what you're describing is and first, let me thank you for your comments about my work. What you're describing is consistent with this research on mild positive illusion as the normal state of the majority of people. And in fact, if we are more realistic, as I agree, many of those in the mystical and Eastern traditions are in more realistic connection with the realities of life and of existence, that often translates to a little bit of depression. That really should be, as the journalist H.L. Mencken once said, the natural state of a thinking man should be depression. A mild depression, hopefully, not too bad, but that's different than this kind of superficial happiness that you're describing, which is, I think, the normal state for most people. And I agree that's not desirable in many ways, both psychologically for an individual's spiritual development, probably, but also, as importantly, maybe socially and politically.
Well, thank you for coming back on. I appreciate this extended interview with you.
Thank you for having me back, Gary, and for your thoughtful comments and questions.
My guest, Dr. Nasir Ghami, G-H-E-M-I, and the book is A First-Rate Madness. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Now, stay tuned for one of the most popular programs in all of Progressive Radio, The Danny Schechter Show.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in my New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.